Hello and welcome to Comic Cuts, the panel show. My name's Kev F. Sutherland. You might know me as a writer and artist for Beano, Marvel Comics, Oink, Doctor Who, the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre, and my graphic novel adaptations of Shakespeare. But chances are you probably don't. My guests today talking comics are Emma Byrne and PJ Holden.
Hello. Hi.
Comic Cuts. We're looking at a panel and we comprise a panel. There's a few of us. So the panel sees a panel and we talk about the comics from a panel we discuss. And we call it Comic Cuts. I have two guests with me today who've brought with them a panel from a comic or something close. We're going to see if we can identify it and talk about it. Maybe we and you will learn something about comics we didn't already know, or maybe we'll just show off a bit and have an enjoyable chat. Let's see. Joining us from Shepherd's Bush is Emma. Emma Byrne. Hello. Good morning, Emma.
Hi, Kev. Nice to see you.
We mentioned Shepherd's Bush and immediately Paul leaps in with, that's the TV studios, because that's all we picture in Shepherd's Bush, except the TV studios aren't there anymore, are they?
They're not, or at least the building is there, but now it's mainly swanky flats. ITV have a bit of the basement, and there's a bit of BBC, I think BBC Worldwide has some offices just on the campus. But it is still so evocative of all of that sort of Saturday morning kids TV or Saturday evening variety shows. It really does feel sort of like 1980s heyday BBC output every time I walk past it, even though now it's mainly just sort of cafes and flats and a staggering view of Westfield. But Shepherd's Bush is evocative of either that or Only Fools and Horses for me. There is something about Shepherd's Bush that I love. It feels like the industrial side of the TV industry still is all that heritage, which I seriously dig.
Paul, did you ever get to Shepherd's Bush and the TV centre in its day?
No, but like England, all of that was a mythical beast to me. Like, it was, you know, Ealing, well, instantly think of the old black and white Ealing comedies on BBC Two. What's really interesting, I think, is that that's all evocative of the TV and film for me from my childhood. And I'm in Belfast, so, you know, I had a different kind of childhood growing up here. But, like, for the next generation coming along, Belfast and Northern Ireland's going to evoke things like Game of Thrones and Krypton and all these other TV shows that were made here. So it's sort of been an interesting, you know, TV and film were a thing that happened somewhere else that doesn't exist here, and then suddenly it does now. So it's kind of interesting watching the change in Northern Ireland as film studios are sort of springing up in the Titanic Quarter, which is where the Titanic was built, but essentially all big empty docklands, and then they've massive film studios there, and they still have some of the set of Game of Thrones and stuff down there. So it's kind of, but it's, I mean, you know, new modern TV, you can keep it. Give me multicolored swap shop and, you know, black and white comedies, and that's good.
Yeah. My first exposure to the Belfast accent was probably Why Don't You growing up. Occasionally go to a school in Belfast.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you when I was a kid, I wasn't on Why Don't You, but I was on, there was a TV show filmed and I was about 8 or 9 or something. I think I was interviewed for it. It was about aliens come down to planet Earth and go around, and they interview all these kids about what they think the world is like. It was probably bookended by aliens, but it was really interviews with kids and I was one of the kids that was. And I can vaguely remember how embarrassing some of the things were. I'll not repeat them because they were awful. But we never got to see it because it was pre videotape recorders and all of that stuff. So I know it was broadcast, but I've no idea what was said on it.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We all had this childhood fascination with the space age and fantasy, and there wasn't so much of it around as there is now. But both of you have gone into the worlds of science, both science real and science fiction. Now, Paul, the science fiction world. Emma, you're actually a robot scientist. You're the sort of person we used to read about. What exactly is a robot scientist?
Well, I spent a long time reading Isaac Asimov growing up, and decided that I wanted Susan Calvin's job. I sort of missed the misogynistic tropes at the time and just wanted Susan Calvin's job. And I was lucky enough I spent a good few years in labs that sort of straddle neuroscience and artificial intelligence, either looking at ways of reproducing I did some stuff reproducing the Primate visual system and the various layers in that, and seeing if we could use that to help a virtual robot navigate it's like Levels of Doom, but whether we could get it to learn language doing that with a collaborator at Middlesex University. That was amazing. Some other stuff at UCL in the Science Museum, looking at how we learn to see, how evolution has created this vast variety of sensory input in the electromagnetic spectrum. I've got to tinker with some fantastic stuff. I am now mainly a full-time writer. I haven't been near a lab in a little while. I do miss it. Yeah, it's fun when I still get to volunteer for experiments or go and just sort of line an fMRI tube for a bit. But yeah, mainly now I'm writing up other people's research in books about either swearing or kids.
So just so I'm clear, you're a scientist who's worked on robots and not an actual robot scientist.
As far as I know, I'm trying to stabbing between my fingers, but I think I'm human.
And because Emma, you've then taken the scientific principle and applied it to, most entertainingly, swearing.
Yes.
You're looking at, is it very much the science of swearing, the application of swearing?
That's right. So when I was working in the lab that was based out of the Science Museum, we were participating in something called the Science Museum Lates, which is they kick all the kids out at sort of 6 p.m., close for an hour or so, set up a bunch of bars, and then have a load of people coming in over the age of 18 to basically have the run of the museum and listen to some interesting talks and participate in some experiments. I say experiments, they are definitely more demonstrations, because wherever alcohol is involved, you find that your results get more erratic as the night goes on. But I was looking at cool experiments that I could do, or demonstrations of experimental setups. And I came across the ice water challenge, or the ice water test. It's called the cold presser test. And you stick your hand in a bucket of ice water and see how long you can keep it in when repeating a neutral word versus how long you can keep it in when you're repeating a swear word. And I thought this was fascinating. And I did what all researchers do, which is you read the paper and then you read all the references in the back of the paper. And then you go and read those papers. And then you read the references in those. And before I knew it, I had a stack of papers on my desk that was about sort of 3 foot high and in peril of, you know, I'd murdered a forest, going, this is all about swearing. And I was just boring on about swearing to everybody that I could talk to. And around that time, I did a BBC training course. And part of that was to pitch a radio show. I pitched a sort of 15 minutes on the science of swearing, which was picked up by Radio 4. And then from that, it grew. And eventually we ended up with this book called Swearing is Good for You.
What I find interesting about that is there's a kind of, taking the science aspect out of that, you've got to ask yourself, is there a kind of magic to it? You know, the idea of words having a power over physics, you know, having a power over your own physical body is kind of interesting. I mean, taking out all the science stuff, you've got essentially, if you say this magic word, you are slightly stronger, which is kind of, it's another way of looking at it.
I mean, the magic happens in the brain, and the fact that swearing draws on so many different parts of the brain that our normal everyday language doesn't. So we see activity in parts of the brain that are to do with emotion, with social cognition, with recognizing threats and so on, which is why, for example, when people have strokes that affect their general language, they can quite often remain quite fluent swearers, which is something that people who, you know, are caring for someone who's had a stroke could be quite stunned by. You know, this person can no longer, you know, whisper terms of endearance, but can say something incredibly rude. And it's nothing personal, and it's not to do with their personality. It's just that languages, in computer science, we call it redundancy, the idea that you have multiple systems that can perform the same function, and if one fails, another will kick in. And swearing is hugely redundant in the brain, which is, that alone is
just
fascinating.
Just in case.
There are very few things in our brain that are quite so distributed.
We'd better keep that F word in about seven different places, because who knows when we'll need it.
Oh, no, someone will need it. And yes, the brain injuries that lead you to not ever swear at all are far rarer and tend to need to be far more specific than the brain injuries that can damage the rest of language. It's really interesting.
I'm presuming from what you're saying is that it's the cultural kind of knowledge that your brain builds up from a swear word that means that if you took the same test with a swear word into Russia to non-native English speakers and asked them to speak the English swear word, it doesn't fire up the same neurons. And that's interesting. So that, I mean, can you then, is that something that you have to learn as a child and those neural pathways have to build up from youth, or can you learn a new swear word in later years that is as powerful?
Yeah, there is a fantastic professor. I think her name is Ayşe Gönçlü, who is Turkish-American, and she's done loads of studies on bilingual people and found that if these are swear words that you learn before the end of your adolescence, they create the same physiological changes in the body and create the same emotional impacts in both languages. But if you become bilingual as an adult and you learn these swear words in a second language, you tend not to have them creating such strong emotional and physiological responses. There seems to be a critical window in which we learn what is swearing.
And swearing and kids is an interesting thing for you, Paul, because in 2000 AD, they always had a parallel language of swearing, drok and grexnix and storm.
Yeah.
Now, now you're allowed more language, but there must still be a cutoff limit in 2000.
I mean, like the history of it is that 2000 AD came out of Action Comics. Action Comics was so terrible a comic that they banned it, and 2000 AD kind of went, ooh, we'd better be really careful. And so the only people we'll kill will be aliens. The only blood we'll spill will be green. And the only bad words we'll use will be drok and grexnix. And a lot of those words came out of came out of the fact that Jerry Finlay Day, who was sort of contributing writer to it, he came up with Rogue Trooper and stuff, had dyslexia and so would mistype a lot of them. So Skrotnik came out of the word escorting, apparently. So
talking of these amazing and fantastic creative things, we've also brought some comics with us to look at. So I'm going to unveil one of the panels that one of us has brought in, and the other two of us will try and guess what it is and talk about it. Listener at home, you can find these hopefully on my website, kevfcomicartist.com, or on the holding artwork wherever you get your podcasts from. But you shouldn't need to see the artwork because we're about to describe it beautifully. And let's have a look at the very first.
As an artist, I feel like one of the great skills I have is painting a picture with words.
Good, because it's Emma's turn first. Emma, you are looking now at the image that's been brought in by Paul. Paul, don't tell us anything about this yet. Emma, there's a chance you might actually recognise it, but have a guess, or rather begin by describing what we're looking at.
Okay, so we have six panels, and one of the things that I'm noticing here is I love the gradient of the background. So it starts with this beautiful tealy green that sort of fades out over the panels and comes back to a dark green again. I'm getting this sense of, you know, reality, something is shifting and then reality again. And we have a character who I'm afraid I don't recognise. They're talking to somebody called Roma, which is obviously a clue, but I don't know this. And they are looking like a somewhat elderly space operatic, possibly baddie. I don't know why. I think I'm getting that from like the lots of green in the background. That's usually a sort of a witchy colour, isn't it? Saying, show myself, Roma. And then the next panel, but which self? Now we have a wizard in full on wizarding gear. You know, the long nails, the purple sleeves, the pointy hat that doesn't have wizard written down it, but is definitely sort of quite unseen university. And then we have someone who is looking a little bit more like, I don't know, somebody who you'd meet at a camera festival, maybe, or a Led Zeppelin fan. Definitely something, I would say mage. This person rolled for mage for their character. They have a staff. Now we've got some kind of slightly furry insectoid. Now we have someone who looks, this is very much sort of a villain from Flash Gordon, in sort of very purplish Yeah, lots of purple and green going on here. I'm loving this. Nice opponent colours. So yeah, what we're seeing is somebody shape-shifting and challenging someone who has asked them to show themselves. And we're getting a sense of the real range of all of these people, but they all seem to be males. They all definitely rock a beard, apart from the insectoid one and then the person who they return to. But I don't know who this character is.
If I can step in and for the benefit of the panelologists, people who study line and drawing technique, this is a black and white line drawing that has been coloured, but because I know the source material, I can actually have a good guess at this because I own this comic. This was originally drawn in black and white, intended to be seen in black and white. It's later been coloured, and it's been coloured well, but coloured in simple colors, probably from the 90s. And we're seeing in this black and white line drawing a superhero style from a Marvel comic style of artist. And I happen to know this is quite early work by someone who went on to be one of the most famous Marvel comic artists. And yes, we have a modern superhero version of this wizard. Then we have a caricature wizard with stars and planets on his pointy hat. Then we have a new age wizard looking a bit like Christopher Lee with a new agey hexagram symbol on his chest. Then we've got a big insect. Then we've got Ming the Merciless meets Steve Ditko designed costume. And then finally, we've got the original guy again. Go on, Emma. Have a guess what this is from.
Ooh. I am not thinking that this is Stephen Strange. I'm not thinking that Stephen Strange was ever drawn like this. But that is the only Marvel Universe sort of wizarding person that I know, to my great chagrin.
One of the most famous wizards in all of Christendom.
Well, I'm going to say Merlin.
And I would concur that we're looking at Merlin, and we're looking at five or six different versions of Merlin, but from a comic written by... I think by this stage it's written by Alan Moore, isn't it? Drawn by Alan Davis, and it's from Captain Britain. Are we right, Paul?
You're right.
Does that mean one of the middle panels is basically Alan Moore doing a self-portrait? I mean, this is just a portrait of Alan Moore.
It could well be Alan Davis doing a drawing of Alan Moore. It's very, very likely. So I've cheated slightly. Kevin said one panel, and this is one of my favourite panels. It is... I consider this a single panel, but it is multiple panels because the character is changing shape and it's doing that thing that the TV can do easily, where a character stays the same but changes. Whereas we can't do that in comics, so we've got to give you different images. But he successfully shows by splitting the dialogue up. So essentially, what you have is this kind of techno wizard guy in the first panel, which is Merlin. And what's happened in the comic at this stage is that Captain Britain, for it is he, has been killed. He's been destroyed by this creature called Fury. The Fury is this kind of dimension hopping ultimate robot that has one singular mission, which is to kill all superheroes. And it's this incredible artificial intelligence that every time it needs to fulfill its mission, it changes what its parameters of what it's able to do is. And so it eventually kills Captain Britain. And Merlin at this stage has rescued. And in this particular strip, I'm going to talk about this all day. Yeah. In this particular strip is from I think it's from Daredevils, or it's from Mighty World of Marvel or something. So they were done in 6-page stories in black and white in, I think, the 80s or so. And it was a guy called Dave Thorpe had written Captain Britain, and he'd put Captain Britain in this kind of alternate universe where I think Dave Thorpe came up with 616, which
he
is
did,
the
yes.
multiverse of where the Marvel universe takes place in the multiverse, which is a 616 then has become, as the Marvel film and TVs expand into the multiverse, we're going to hear the number 616, we're going to see it a lot. Not all stems from this strip, which is interesting in and of itself. But at this stage, the Fury has killed Captain Britain, completely destroyed him, and all that's left, and the name of the strip is A Rag, a Bone, a Hank of Hair. And in this story, Merlin, along with his daughter Roma, and they're in what's called Otherworld, which is the kind of place that Merlin exists in, and they're basically rebuilding Captain Britain, and they're rebuilding him from his DNA, and they're re-injecting him with his memory. And Roma's job is, as Merlin describes, is your job is simply to build a body. Mine's is to kind of rebuild a mind, to kind of give this person back all of his memories, and everything who he is, and all of his drives and his motivations, and they tweak his power and his armor, and Roma kind of says, shouldn't you show yourself to the captain? Shouldn't you reveal that you've kind of rebuilt him? And he kind of goes, show myself, but which self? This one or this? He wouldn't have known me. And in the end, that is for the best. And that's that moment from the strip. And the last, as Captain Britain's body is rebuilt, slowly rebuilt, and you can see the circulatory system, and which I think Alan Moore would later revisit as an idea with Captain, Dr. Manhattan, the kind of the rebuilding from the cell upwards. You see the body being rebuilt, and you see that Captain Britain is placed back on Earth 616, his original Earth, and there's a moment where Captain Britain is standing beside a stone henge, and crying with gratitude that Merlin's plucked him out of the time stream at the moment before he was destroyed and saved him, which of course is not what happens. And that's kind of, it's a heartbreaking bit where he's so grateful for him, but that's not what Merlin has done at all. Merlin's got his own nefarious plans going on. It's great. I mean, one of the key things, and I mean, one of the reasons I like this panel is that it essentially says that Merlin particularly shows different aspects of himself depending on what the circumstances are.
Yeah.
And I think we all do that. I think we do that on Twitter and Facebook and real life. And that's a thing that we all do, and that it's almost impossible to know someone fully in the round because they're always keeping something from someone else. They're always showing something of themselves. And that's one of the particular reasons I like this panel.
Well, another thing that was happening here, you were describing how we can do this kind of thing on film. Back in 1981, 1982, when this comic strip was happening, you couldn't do stuff like that. In 1981, can anybody remember The Doctor Who of 1981, because it certainly couldn't have done a special effect like this without you laughing out loud.
Was tricky, but things like multiple exposures, since Man Ray and photography, but I'm thinking particularly Metropolis, the ways of overlaying exposures, you could do it, but it was so prohibitively expensive.
I can't remember who did it, but it's the effect on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I think it was Lon Chaney, either Lon Chaney or Lon Chaney Jr. And what he'd done was he'd applied a coloured makeup to his face that changed with the light. Mm-hmm. And so when they changed the lighting, which of course all looked like it, because it was black and white and it all looked exactly the same, but when he changed the lighting, which was maybe a green to a red or something, it changed the makeup in his face and that changed how he looked, which is an incredible effect even to this day. It still sort of holds up. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the thing that's been really interesting as a comic artist is to watch the slow, gradual flip between these are things you can only do in comics because we have an infinite budget, to these are things you can only do in TV because although you have an infinite budget in comics, if you ask your comic artist to draw 10,000 soldiers on horseback, you're not going to get much of a comic out of them. That's, you know, you're going to kill them by the end of that. So it's been watching that flip has been kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's very true. And also the amount of money that's spent on making comics big and bright and shiny. I mean, this Captain Britain was originally done in black and white, printed in black and white, and the colour is perfunctory. I think I'm very happy.
It was interesting listening to focus and hone in on the colour, because to be honest, I had never even paid attention to the background colour of this before now. It had never occurred to me there was a graduation going on in the green to the sort of fading out from a dark green to the other greens, and even saying this is a kind of witchy colour. That's all interesting. I kind of wonder if there was thinking like that going on, or was it more kind of this is the colour of fill that we've got on our computer right now, so let's just do this. It's hard to know. know. Yeah, I mean, there is always a danger, and again, you know, speaking as an artist, there's always a danger of people overreading decisions you've made, because, you know, sometimes you do them because time constraints, sometimes you do them because that just happened to be the one you picked that day, and if it was a different day, you'd have picked a different one, and then people can sometimes read a lot into it. But absolutely, I mean, the idea of it's being a witchy color, and I think you pointed out that the purple and the green are kind of fighting colors, you know, that's all very interesting and stuff I've never paid attention to, to my shame.
I mean, even just, I think for me, the one that feels really deliberate rather than just, you know, these are the eight colours I've got in my palette, is the way that we start with that very saturated background in the first sort of division of the panel. And that background fades out, that sort of sense of, if you were doing this as a TV thing, as a filmic thing, you know, the sort of overlaying of these images, that they would get sort of more blurred and more that sense of a greater sense of unreality. And then that final panel snaps back to that same rich teal. There's that moves my eye through it. And there's a sense of continuity, and then bam, discontinuity back to where we were at night. That to me, because a lot of what I was studying with the artificial intelligence is our visual system, and particularly the point of our color visual system, because it's really expensive, but it does some amazing things for us in terms of navigating the natural world. And I feel something about that background gradient, that someone's gone, okay, this is where colour doesn't just sort of add pretty, it does something for the storytelling. And it, I'm not sure if that's deliberate, but I think that may well be.
Yeah. One thing I'm not 100% sure of is, in the comics, how many of these versions of Merlin we've ever seen. So I think we've seen, because this sort of techno, kind of slightly balding, kind of long grey hair, no beard look is definitely an invention of the Alan Moore, Alan Davis run. The black bearded, very typical evil wizard look is possibly something from the comic, but I feel like the one that we've kind of referred to as the Alan Moore like is probably closest to one that we've definitely seen in the comic. The Ming the Merciless, no idea where that came from. The ant, the furry ant thing, what is that about? But it's kind of interesting to see that there's an alien in there as well, you know. I mean, later on this strip would go to essentially this opened up the multiverse to Marvel Comics. There was no, I don't think there was a big multiverse prior to this, but this opened up strips with multiple versions of Captain Britain and you know, Captain Earth strip one from a kind of 1984 version of of the Marvel universe and stuff, and there, I think there's a, later on there's a funeral on Otherworld where you see all of these various Captain Britons attending a single funeral. So it's but there's a, you know, and this strip is just brilliant. It is prior to Alan Moore doing Miracle Man or Marvel Man, and it's prior to the Watchmen, and it's prior just a little bit to V for Vendetta, but it's sort of a prototype to a lot of those ideas, and you know, it's just it's right in the sweet spot for me, for Alan Davis and Alan Moore art. It's just the sweet spot for me. I mean, I often think, because you sort of forget how youthful comics is as an industry, that it's, you know, maybe 100 years old, but certainly the comics that we all think of, it's almost like pop music. You don't think of pop music prior to 1950. You know, it's 1960 and onwards. So Giants Walk Among Us now, you know, like today, particularly the Rolling Stones drummer died, and you kind of realize, wow, we are among giants. There's no, you don't realize it until they die or something happens to them. But to be alive at the time that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Alan Moore and Alan Davis, and when these kind of giants of the industry are there, it's a kind of wondrous, it's an amazing one of life's gifts to you that you totally take for granted. You know.
Right. Well, we've just been spending an awful long time looking at the Captain Britain by Alan Moore and Alan Davis, the panel that was brought in by Paul Holden. And now we're going to have a look at the panel that Emma Byrne has brought in. Okay.
Oh, I know exactly what this is from.
Oh, brilliant. I thought you might. Well, okay, guess why I chose it.
To avoid spoilers. Okay, listen at home. Can I just describe what we're looking at in case you can't see these pictures? We are looking at a main central image of a silhouette picture of a man in a wheelchair grabbing hold of a man standing up who's holding a bottle that's spilling. So it's a domestic argument between man.
And it's all in silhouette.
In silhouette. Silhouette man in wheelchair and possibly younger man standing up. And above that, there are three symbols which are showing sign language symbols. There's a hand holding up three fingers, index finger, index finger long. Then there's a hand holding clenched fist, but with one index finger looped over thumb. And finally, hand holding up with just index finger with thumb looped over it. You can probably read those from my descriptions. My descriptions were so good. Okay.
That's palm facing outward when those, because I don't know if back of hand facing outward with three letters up is different than palm facing outward with three letters up. I'd imagine they are, but I don't know. Now, to be fair, if I'd just seen the silhouette, I might have struggled to guess what this was, but I've seen the surrounding. There's little half a surrounding panel around each of it, and I can tell from the colouring and the art style what this is exactly. It is Matt Fraction and David Aja's Hawkeye. Am
correct.
I right?
That is right. Book 19. I had to go.
I wouldn't have got the book number.
I had to look it up because I gave away my. I had so many copies of the trade in which this was collected, and I keep giving it away. And then it got to the point where I couldn't get it anymore, so I had to go repurchase it from Comixology so I could be ready for this episode. Hawkeye has lost his hearing in a fight. And had also lost his hearing as a child, was deaf as a child. And this is a fight between him and his brother, which is brewing throughout the entirety of this comic book. And the thing that I love is that I came to comics very late in life, and I think it was probably comics e-readers that helped me, the guided view version of it, because I didn't have older brothers or blokes, you know, male friends who would show me how to read a comic. So I was kind of taught how to read a comic by comics book apps, and I got so into it. And David Aja and Matt Fraction's Hawkeye series was the one that I think really... Oh, just solidified me. I mean, I nearly brought Deadpool, and I also nearly brought The Amazing Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage. But in the end, it's like, what's the one that stayed with me this long? And it's this arc in which you are made to feel like an outsider if you don't speak American Sign Language. And as someone who has always loved code breaking and has always loved language, having a comic book, a comic episode in which dialogue is usually blank bubbles in this. There's a lot of blank bubbles. The shape of the bubbles is very indicative of tone. So they're very jagged when his brother Barney is yelling at him, but there's nothing in them. Or there are other ones where the typography of it is very mixed up and there are bits that are bracketed. And as someone who struggles a little with my own hearing, that idea of something that it could be this word or that word, you having to kind of guess from context. You know, he's the son of a bench. And then this is way before The Good Place used, you know, these sort of elisions of swearing, but this use of slightly corrupted hearings. And it reminded me when you're talking about in 2000 AD and the dyslexia becoming part of the slang and the swearing that's used. But this idea of being made to be a little bit of an outsider, and then they've given you enough clues. It's beautiful. There are just enough clues, if you don't speak ASL, to start to understand some of the finger spelling. And that is because they've given proper nouns throughout the book. So at the very beginning, Hawkeye is finger spelled. And then later on, when they're in the doctor's office, his brother is spelling Clint. And you know that it must be Clint because it's five letters and he's looking at him. And so you know that the clenched fist with the thumb between those first two fingers is a T. And the three fingers up, it does, you know, iconically it is kind of a W. And you just, what is going on here? What could be being said here? WTF, what the fuck? And so partly it resonates with me with the swearing, but also it's the code breaking, and that moment at which you're sort of going, okay, I'm starting to resettle into this world where I haven't been able to understand the communication, and now some of it's starting to make sense. And that idea of experiencing Clint's journey of I don't understand to I partially understand to there is more dialogue in straight text later on to, yeah, okay, I can comfortably communicate now. And you are taken through this emotional journey through the distancing effect, if you don't use ASL, of this form of sign language. But you're given enough clues by the writer and the artist, Fraction and Aja, to immerse yourself into it, to treat it like a code and to puzzle it out like a mystery book. And the other thing I love in terms of colouring, it's not in this one. I think it's one of the ones that's collected in Little Hits. But David Aja talks about how he treats colour both on the page, but also throughout the book. And he gives the layout of the entire book and how the colour palette changes through the book over the pages to change the feeling of the story. And then in this one, where you have two things that are going on, it's a very muted, cool, dark grays, greens, browns, whenever you're in Clint's hearing loss world. And then whenever you see flashes of his childhood, it's very sort of orange, yellow, red, lots of sort of hazard colours. This scene of a domestically violent family in which he is a misfit. And then when you see the tracksuit bros, who are the antagonists in this, that is all in its own colour palette as well. So it's very clear on some of the pages at the end where he's communicating, you know, this is me here, and this is why, you know, this is what's happening with the tracksuit bros. The clashing of those colours on those few pages is this real sense of, you know, you can't use actual sound to tell people what is, you know, what is going on. There's a transition from, so I do a lot of stage tech stuff, and I work with a sound engineer who is so over this, and whenever it happens in shows or TV programs, he gets really mad. But that idea from theme tune goes to something diegetic, something where you can see where it is in the scene. But audio in TV and in film, you can use all sorts of clues as to, you know, is this flashback, is this memory, is this something that's coming from somewhere else? To do that flat on the page, using the color palette as saying, this is what's in the room with you, this is what's being spoken about, it is just so clear.
I feel like I should point out Matt Hollingsworth did the colours on...
This is correct.
Yeah, just to give credit to the full team.
So Matt Hollingsworth then, to whom all credit should go for the amazing use of palettes throughout this series.
On that page we're looking at now, which is the scene with the close-up of the eyes and so on, and the bottom row of panels where there's no background colour at all. Mm. Now, it could well be I just asked for no background color there, but the decision to leave that white is a ballsy move to kind of go, right, no color here, we're just going to leave that, because it focuses you entirely on those characters and it brings you into the moment that they're both having together. You know, that they, everything else is out of focus, they're not concentrating on any of that. And it's a little like reading, in the experience of reading, where you're reading something and the world vanishes around you. So it may be given the equivalent of what that would be like to communicate to someone with sign language, where you're feeling that everything's focused on their movements and on what they're doing with their hands. As someone who doesn't speak any sort of sign language at all, or use any sort of sign language, it probably maybe gives the incorrect impression, but it feels like this might be as close as I'll ever feel to that, being part of that, and, you know, being that and communicating in that way.
And thinking very much about what can be done in a comic different from what would happen in another art form. We've got the symbols for the sign reading looking very much like explanatory symbols you would get in health and security panels on walls.
Yeah, a little airport.
They remind me of airplane evacuation instructions.
Exactly. Yeah. And they integrate beautifully with how the line drawings on a page work. They're doing what line drawings on a page work. If you turned this into a TV program or a movie, the line drawings on a page would stand out because they were line drawings. And this page, with its beautiful symmetry, and the symmetry is used, I can see elsewhere in the book. Again, it's something you can only do when you've got a whole load of images on a page in the way that comics work. It's really using our art form.
The only scene I've ever seen, I think, in film and TV where two characters are in a pure white background is when Morpheus is talking to Neo in The Matrix, and that you couldn't carry it off in a gritty, day-to-day.
Are you forgetting all of the great sketches of Kenny Everett's video show?
Oh, of course, of course.
All in the best possible taste.
Thank you, Emma Byrne and Paul Holden.
Did I forget Cupid Stunt?
We have just been looking at Hawkeye. The story is written by Matt Fraction and drawn by David Ager. And Captain Britain, the story is written by Alan Moore and drawn by Alan Davis. Some wonderful artwork for you to seek out. If you have any questions to ask us, you should be able to find us all on the socials. Emma, where do we find you on the socials?
Yeah, you find me as Cy Ryby, which is, yes, unfortunately, then I have to spell it, but SCI as in science, WRI as in writer, and then BY as in Byrne, so Cy Ryby. Or you can just pop to emmaburn.net, and I usually update where I'm likely to be either talking or appearing on that. Have a look for How to Build a Human, which is all about how basically your brain develops from birth to adulthood. Or Swearing is Good for You, which is what your brain does when it realises what exactly being an adult involves.
There you go. You'll find that wherever you find all your Emma Byrnes. And Paul, where do we find you on the socials?
There is another more famous Emma Byrne, I should point out. I don't play football for Arsenal or either.
True. When you Google Emma Byrne, that's what you'll find. When you Google Paul Holden, you'll find lots of Paul Holden, which is why you go by PJ, I guess.
PJ Holden PJ Holden sounds like someone Paul Holden could live next door to you. That's why I just avoid Paul Holden. You'll find me on Twitter at Paul J Holden. And my blog is www.pauljholden.com. So there we go.
And you'll find me at Kev F Comic Artist and the website kevfcomicartist.com. Hey, why not click subscribe to be sure of hearing every episode when it comes out, and leave us a review. It always helps. Thank you again to Emma Byrne and to Paul PJ Holden, and to you at home for listening. I've been Kev F, and this has been Comic Cuts, the panel show.